Let me start by being maybe a little provocative. You all have covered a lot of ground, a lot of fine-tuned analysis. I would argue that a lot of what's being talked about really can't be influenced by monetary policy or the central banks. So do we need to retitle this session Monetary Policy Outlook and make it Fiscal Outlook and How We Get Some? Jump in.
Well, I'll go first because I wrote a piece, I don't know, a couple of years ago for the Financial Times. And I think it was titled something like The Dual Mandate, Right Goals, Wrong Institution, question mark. And so that's exactly to your point. And I think in that I even went as far as to, you know, put forward the idea provocatively again that maybe we need something akin to a Taylor rule, but it needs to guide fiscal policy instead of monetary policy. Mm. Yeah.
Does anybody else want to chime in on this? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that, but the point is the Fed has decided that the labor markets are too tight and therefore we need to do something, and they're going to do what they can do to prevent labor markets from becoming tighter than they already are, and that is raising interest rates. Okay, so what I'm arguing is their argument for raising rates is flawed because labor markets are not tight. We are not on the verge of inflation taking off. And so I think that their policy making is wrong. Whether or not raising interest rates is going to have a big impact on labor markets, I mean, we can debate that. That's a completely different question.
Well, I would say this stuff work automatically. Actually, now we have two parts to this question. One is, can you use fiscal policy? I think there is certainly we could have had a much more intelligent fiscal policy over the last 8, 10, 25 years in many dimensions. It is true, however, that we have the U.S. Debt is fairly large. It is true, however, that we are the reserve currency country, and so therefore we can get away with things that other countries can't. I think it is debatable whether, I don't know what your price tag is on your program. it does matter, right? It does matter in terms of, unless you're going to finance it through taxes, which I don't think you are. At some point, you don't have to be a Reinhardt Rogoff fanatic in order to say that there are some there is scope there. The phenomenon of crowding out does exist, and I don't think, just to disagree with Randall, I don't think it is either accurate or fair to say that the Federal Reserve has decided, at least my observation, has decided it's time to stop the economy growing. There's still this plenty, you know. If you think the new natural rate is 3%, funds rate is 3%, then in fact they're now providing stimulus. And I think one of the reasons why they're providing stimulus, Janet Yellen was, after all, a student of James Tobin, as well as Ted Truman, by the way, but that's irrelevant. They obviously are prepared to allow some overshoot, and in fact would be allowed to accept some overshoot. So it's not as if they're trying to stop the economy from growing. If they were, they would want to have growth now at the rate of whatever they think is the potential growth rate, which is more than the 2.2 or 2.3% that they're forecasting. So I think it's not right to say that the Federal Reserve has decided that it's time to stop the economy growing at a rate faster than the estimated growth rate of potential.
Okay, let me raise another question. Stephanie, I thought you brought up some really interesting points about just how wildly different the growth projections are depending on what kind of Trump people think you have, and nobody knows. I will say from my own political reporting, I think that varies from week to week, depending on who he's listening to. Let's say for the sake of argument that he's going to be a conventional Republican. And what we're going to get through is basically, as you said, tax cuts. Some would argue that could provide a certain amount of growth. I would actually say I think there hasn't been a lot of evidence for that in the last 20 years, at least sustained growth. where do, let's assume that as a baseline. Then what advice would you all give the Fed? Where do we go from here if that's the scenario in the next 2 years?
If the scenario is that all we get is something
Republican-like. A normal kind of laissez-faire, well, tax cut,
look,
Republican president.
I mean, if you're looking at the Moody's forecast, the Moody's forecast allows for, you know, a continued expansion, albeit not as robust as we would get in the baseline scenario. So what does the Fed do in that, if that turned out to be the case? What does the Fed do? I think the Fed basically does very little in a scenario like that. What should the Fed do? What could the Fed do if they wanted to see something more like the baseline, said, oh, this is slower growth than we're willing to tolerate? We'd rather see the kind of growth that we would have gotten under the no-Trump scenario. To the extent that they, A, have room to move interest rates, and B, that that actually does something, perhaps that's something that the Fed can do. I honestly don't think there's a lot that the Fed can do to push against a modest slowdown in growth.
Go ahead, Ted.
Actually, I don't know whether others agree.
I didn't understand. It was very interesting, your presentation. All of them have been very interesting. But I don't understand on these baselines that you did, I haven't looked at them, how all policy options are inferior to whatever the analyst then considers the baseline, which means that we want to somehow continue, but the baseline must be we have to continue what with the Obama policies, whatever you think they were. So it's not clear to me what the baseline is. That's a different point, I think. So my colleague Dave Stockton, just to give you one data point, in his presentation last week, which you can find on the web, is assuming, he puts his finger up in the air, and he's assuming $120 billion of tax cuts and $60 billion of net expenditure increase, which he over $180 billion a year over the next 2 years. So 2018 and 19, 17, 18, can't remember. Next 2 years, I don't remember exactly how he did his years, which he said will give you will boost growth by 0.75% at the end of the period, if I remember, and then the Federal Reserve will respond. The Federal Reserve's action by essentially speeding up the point to which they get to normal. In quotation marks, would take 0.25% after that. So you can get fiscal stimulus, I think, in response probably, and a positive sugar high from it. I think the real question is has to do with what you're spending on. Doing it all through tax cuts is much less efficient for the economy as a whole than doing it through spending. And that's one of the reasons why you get less of an impact with the 1% of GDP program, but you only get 0.75% of GDP in gross ceteris paribus expansion.
Did you want to jump in, Ray?
Well, I sort of disagree with the premise. I think the Fed should be focused on what it should have been focused on in 2007, right before we crashed. They ought to be looking at the financial system. They ought to be looking at what banks are doing. They ought to be looking at the debt ratios in the private sector. They ought to be looking at the debt, the layering of debt on debt within the financial system itself. Inflation is not in danger. It's just not there. There's no reason to be focused on that at all. They ought to be focused on what is going to crash us.
So this is a good point maybe to bring up another big sort of question and maybe touch on some of the earlier morning presentations as well. One of the big questions in the recovery, I'll put in quotation marks, has been why is there so much corporate cash on the sidelines? And you look at the effects of monetary policy on corporate bond offerings. Meanwhile, you've got cash hoarding abroad. All the monetary policy that we've gotten hasn't gotten much wage inflation except at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. What now? What does all that mean? And you know, to some of the questions that were raised about when is the next correction coming and where might the next recession be coming from, are those questions relevant? Do you want to pick up and then we can jump in?
I think inequality is a big issue, and what will be the impact of raising interest rates on inequality? So corporations aren't borrowing, but lower-income households have not recovered. Okay, and they are in debt. So why raise interest rates now?
Does anyone, I'm just curious, if anyone here, that's a very good argument, does anyone see an argument for low rates actually didn't do much to help poor people anyway, you know, that they basically created more financial instability? Is there, can anybody take up that point?
Well, just in addition, of course, they aren't getting the low rates. So low rate policy doesn't trickle down to the very bottom. They might be paying 300%, 600% interest. Okay. It doesn't trickle down.
Let me ask a couple more questions and open it up to the floor. Dodd-Frank has now been sort of thrown open for questioning. Who knows where that's going to go? But if you all were starting from scratch, thinking about what the Fed should be doing, what regulators should be doing in general for the financial system, what would you recraft? What parts of it would you keep? What parts would you like to see be changed?
Scott. Well, that's an easy one. We'll see. Short answer. No. So I'm going to go back to the natural rate thing because it was mentioned if you think their natural rate of interest is 3, then the Fed's not slowing the economy down. They're just withdrawing stimulus a bit. So from a Minskian perspective, there's no such thing as a natural rate of interest. That's the core point, that you can't talk about an interest rate in the economy irrespective of the financial positions of the private sector, irrespective of the fact that there's many and highly variable spreads over, say, any sort of interest rate the Fed wants to set. And it's still not even clear from the natural rate of interest folks which interest rate is the one that's supposed to be natural.
Anybody else want to add to that?
Well, yeah. Also in Keynes, there's a different natural rate for every level of unemployment. So it's not unique at all. The Fed is chasing a moving target. It changes every time the employment rate changes. We don't observe it. They don't know what it is. We don't know what it is. It's a pretty silly target.
Okay. Well, I think, well.
Yeah, so
well,
from.
No, I thought we were supposed to talk about Dodd-Frank and.
I kind of did.
Well, I don't. Well,
so, you go ahead.
Go ahead. If you want to talk about Dodd-Frank, I don't think the natural rate is. I think
it wasn't specifically
Dodd-Frank.
It's sort of where would you go, right? Yes. And so, I'll just start with what I laid out in my presentation, which is, central bank isn't manipulating interest rates as much as it is making sure underwriting is good and the same things that Randy was just talking about, and that you recognize that there's an monetary and fiscal policy are not both affecting aggregate demand the same way. We want to talk about, well, fiscal stimulus isn't effective, or it's more effective when you spend versus tax, all that sort of stuff. Well, before you even do that, you have to recognize if you stimulate with monetary policy, you're encouraging private debt. If you stimulate with fiscal policy, you're not. If you don't have that, then you're not even talking about reality to start with. Secondly, if you slow down the economy raising interest rates, it depends. The effect is going to be very different depending on where you are in terms of financial positions of the private sector, hedge, speculative, Ponzi, right? And that's just a simple analysis. You start to throw a bunch of layers on that if you want. And so if we're starting over, Minsky's proposal was for the central bank to manage the financial system and for fiscal policy to be more concerned about countercyclical policy. So, start there.
Okay, why don't we open it up for questions? Question over here.
Thank you very much for a wonderful panel. In contrast to much of the concern this morning, though, there was little discussion about productivity growth, except to note the difference between productivity growth and wages. And so I'm wondering, Randy, for example, in your proposal, you just seem not concerned with productivity at all. It's just employment as a last resort. And so I'm wondering, do you all see that as a limit to the growth potential of the economy or not?
Good question.
I think productivity growth is largely a residual, and it will be low when aggregate demand is growing slowly. It's mostly a residual. Our economy is a service sector economy. a large part of the service sector, productivity is measured by wages. If wages aren't growing, productivity doesn't grow. Increase it to $15 an hour, we're going to see a huge boost in productivity.
Question back here in the middle, and then I'll come to the other side.
I would like to, First of all, everybody's been talking about the bank. Want me to get up? Can you hear me? Talking about the banking situation and the banks. John Arthurs just wrote a terrific article that I gave to the earlier person who spoke in the Financial Times the other day on instead of doing things with Glass-Steagall, you've got to start all over from scratch. Now, this was in John. This is John Arthurs, and this isn't me. I'm not an economist. Everybody here is an economist. But with reference
smart.
To wages, you can't go ahead and say $15 an hour is the proper wage for everywhere in the United States. You don't live in the Central Valley of this country. You don't know what different areas of the Central Valley and the farming areas. I do. Okay, everything changes. Plus, there's something that has not been brought up at all. In all the, and I've been here for years, in all the things I see in the banking and everything else, nobody, all you discuss is education, college, this, that. But like Germany, why don't you all discuss how Germany goes ahead and does? And that's job training in schools. You don't need to graduate from college or prep school. You don't have enough carpenters. You don't have enough people fixing refrigerators. You go ahead and figure out what it costs to go ahead and figure and get people in here. Vocational schools used to be a big thing in the city of New York for air vocation schools. Somebody's looking at me. You probably might, if you lived in New York, you remember the vocational schools. There are no vocational schools. They're not getting, and if you take a look at Germany, their prime situation is vocational schools. Not just recently, it's been going on for a long time. We have to, where do you get the money? Where do you teach vocation? I'll tell you one of the greatest places to learn how to teach vocation. I'm older than most of you here, except for some of you. But many of us, but just only a couple of people. Because many of us know all about vocational schools, even though we might have graduated from college. You know why? We're in the military. And the military to this day teaches vocation and training on the job better than anybody else. And they can set up a program.
Okay,
how to go ahead and teach it.
Is the question, would a revamp of vocational education at the secondary and community college level make a big difference in terms of productivity? Is that the question for the panel then?
What I'm saying is I think it'll make a difference in productivity.
Okay.
It'll make a difference in people for wage rates. There's a lot of, look, I'm not an economist. I'm here because I'm sort of involved with Bard College, okay?
Okay. Let me just, if anybody wants to weigh in on this quickly, and then I'll make a comment.
Stephanie does.
I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, I worked for a senator who made training in vocational skills a big part of his platform. And so, yeah, Germany does that. We should definitely do more of that. The umbrella for the term education can be as broad as you like. Absolutely. Germany does it. They also offer free public colleges and universities. So they've got both.
Yeah, no, it's also worth saying that, you know, Bill Dudley, of all people, is now calling student debt bubble a drag on rates. Yeah. So I think that speaks to your point. Yeah. I want to just make sure, we've only got about 15 minutes to get a lot more questions. So there's one in the back here that...
So we've been hearing a lot about how, you know, the trend growth rate is lower, which means the equilibrium real rate is lower, and then the Fed just came out with a paper a few weeks ago saying that this means they're going to be at the zero bound 40% of the time going forward. So this is like the existential dread in policy circles right now. So some people are saying, okay, maybe we should raise the inflation target so we can, you know, raise interest rates and then have more room to cut them. Esther George, I think, very explicitly stated this morning that they shouldn't overshoot on higher inflation because higher inflation is regressive because it's mostly rental inflation. So two-part question. One, who's right, in that argument? And then the second question is, you know, given the contents of Scott's presentation, does it even matter either way?
Scott, do you want to start with that?
No.
Oh, come on.
Well, I'll jump on those. I don't think Scott's presentation. That's other people's business. On the zero lower bound question, that is a very important question, right? It is true, I think, that the the world converged, the advanced world converged on 2% without giving very much thought to what it all meant. And the case for, and a couple of my colleagues have written about this, case for raising the target is at least sound. I'm not sure that I'm not necessarily endorsing it, but it is sound. It certainly ought to be examined because it has this advantage that if you want to avoid circumstances in which you get Stephanie's negative interest rates and all that sort of stuff going on, then you want to be able to stop things when you get to the zero lower bound. There are costs on, at least the people who argue about the cost of inflation would say that there are costs on the other side. And the hardest thing is to manage the transition between where you are and where you're going. But in fact, several central banks around the world have actually raised their inflation targets over the last two decades that they've had inflation targeting. So it is a very reasonable question, and that piece of research, which I think came out again, but it's been around at the Fed for some considerable length of time. But I think it's a good question.
Go ahead.
So was that Michael? Was that who asked that?
Yeah. Okay. Matthew.
Or Matthew, when then. I say Michael. Anyway, so I think the point you were making about from my presentation is that, of course, if the Fed's raising interest rates to avoid inflation, and then what they end up doing is sort of sending us off in the other direction, and then people lose their jobs, et cetera, and they're far worse off than if you'd just allowed the inflation on the rent to go from 2 to 3%. Is that sort of...
Well, more just that, like, is this even the right way to think about, you know, getting interest rates sustainably higher, or does it have more to do with balance sheet composition, and so this debate is just kind of, you know, is it important or not? Mm. Is it the right debate?
I think I would say it's based on an incorrect paradigm, yeah. Because, for all the reasons I gave, I guess, that this view that we'll just raise interest rates a bit, regardless of financial positions, et cetera, and everything will just smooth out to 2% inflation and 2% GDP growth, and we'll be fine. And so that person with the rent, you know, now they can afford it, right? Although, now they might have a harder time getting a job as well because the economy's not growing at 3 if it could. It's growing at 2, right, in their own framework.
Can I just
go ahead?
If you think about this, so the main argument to raise the rates is so be able to lower them if the higher rates crash the economy. Is that sensible policy making?
No, actually, that's not the main argument. There are two arguments. That's one argument, which is the other argument is that if you kept, let's say, interest rates at 0, right, and then inflation went to whatever level you thought that inflation is becomes a problem, right, then you will actually have to raise interest rates to a great degree, as we did in the late 1970s, early 80s, right, and indeed crush the economy. So the objective actually is a dual objective, to position yourself so you can deal with the downturns in the future, but also to avoid a situation in which you actually literally have to slam on the brakes, as was done in 1979.
Right. The problem with that framework, which is what the Fed has been using, is that's the way they've done their policy the last 30 years, and it's failed every single time. And that paradigm didn't allow them to see the financial crisis coming either.
Where is the evidence that low interest rates cause inflation?
Mm. That too.
Mm. Okay, I like this question here. Spicy debate. That's my job.
I guess my question would be for the three of you who are associated with Minsky's. My question would be for the three of you associated with the Minsky Center here. Anyone completing a doctoral program in economics or in finance today is generally not exposed to the idea of Minsky. The policymakers are from the traditional neoclassical synthesis school. So the response tools are from there. Now, what are you doing to get the word out so people become aware that there is an alternative approach?
Well, Stephanie's been advising political candidates, but...
the Levy Institute has been holding events like these for years and bringing policymakers... So they run an MA program where, I mean, we are training and producing students who then go on to take positions advising members of Congress.
Let me rephrase that question slightly, if I might, and draw you all out. you know, our lunch speaker, we were talking about China and the fact that that might not be an economy that lends itself to a Minsky moment. When and where and how might the next Minsky moment be coming? And, you know, how do you all, where are the lessons? You know, maybe you can kind of tell us, you know, be a little crystal ball gazing here and you know, go out on a limb. It's the end of the day. You're about to get a drink. give us some prognostications here.
First?
Yeah.
I would ask Randy to field this question, but I think I would start by saying I'm not sure that everyone is comfortable with the idea of the Minsky moment, the term itself. And I know that Jan has written and talked about this a lot. So you want to say something
that
as a springboard?
So Minsky, from about 1989, developed this analysis of the rise of what he called money manager capitalism. In many ways, it's like finance capitalism. Finance capitalism crashed in 1929, and we got rid of it with the New Deal. So it completely transformed the financial system, but also put in safety nets and so on, and big government and big central bank and all that stuff. What did we do this time? Well, money manager capitalism crashed in a very similar way to what happened in 2007. The depths of the recession were not nearly as deep because we had the big government there and it had something of a safety net. And the Fed originated $29 trillion in loans to rescue the financial system. They had not done that in the 1930s, but we also didn't change the system. A little bit of changes around the edges. Financial markets did react a little bit in the area of home mortgage loans, so I don't think that they're doing what they were doing between 2004 and 2006. They're just doing that now with student loans and with car loans, which are smaller than home mortgages, maybe won't have the same impact when those things crash. But the point is, we didn't change the financial system. If anything, we made the too big to fail institutions even bigger. So they're now even too bigger to fail. And told them, go back to doing what you're doing. So we will crash. Where will it start? In the financial system. That's where it always starts.
Liquidity, not leverage?
Well, it starts as a liquidity problem that I think is not an irrational one. So this is not like the bank runs of the 19th century, which we say, oh, it was irrational. You need a lender of last resort really quick. Doesn't take very long. You just lend like crazy, and then everything's fine. The problem is that the liquidity run begins because you think they're insolvent, and they were insolvent. And so it takes a long time. You got to lend for more than 2 years at very low rates and hope they can recover and then can start all over again, which is what we did.
Okay. There was a question against the wall back here.
Mr. Reid, looking at your presentation, do you believe that for the American economy, it would be a good thing to go with the wage-led growth or the multiplier effect of Keynes? Would those two things would be good for the American economy, or even the Tobin tax for the stock market?
Well, I don't think I want to go in that one. wage-led growth. Minsky always argued that government spending-led growth is the safest kind you can have. Okay. Because that allows the private sector's balance sheet to improve over the growth period. A private sector-led growth means that the private sector balance sheet will be deteriorating, and so that is a dangerous kind. However, wage-led growth would be a very good thing because our problem really is that wages have been stagnant for too long. And so wage-led growth allows consumption out of income, which is not dangerous. So yeah, wage-led growth would be very nice.
Question over here.
I want to turn to issues of political economy, if I might, adding in political economy to this discussion about monetary policy, and particularly full employment that Dr. Ray, you were talking about, but also be interested in all of your opinions. Particularly the article from Kolesky. I think it's a really important article that's not brought up frequently enough in discussions of full employment, which is essentially this idea that the political aspects of full employment are extremely unpopular given the current distribution of power in a capitalist system. For example, full employment would undermine the ability of the capitalist class to a certain extent to control wages, also to have greater authority over the reserve army of labor. So I guess my question would be, what do you see as the necessary steps to move this idea of full employment from economic theory to actual reality? And additionally, what type of agency do you see individual politicians or parties as having given the distribution of power in a capitalist system between the capitalist class and the proletariat, to use a Marxist term?
Marxism is trending on Google, I will say. It's true. Stephanie, how about you? You grab that one.
Okay. Well, I'm just not certain that is a correct. I mean, it may have been true at the time Kaletsky wrote it. I'm not sure that it's true today. That is, that employers would have great opposition to tighter and tighter labor markets for the reasons that you laid out, at least with respect to this ELR program that Randy has put forward and that the Levy Institute, many here, have championed for decades. I agree that some employers will not like the fact that there is a job ready and waiting for anyone who chooses, that they don't like whatever it is about the current employment scheme, and that they can walk away anytime and have employment. But keep in mind, that employment is not meant to compete with the broad array of private sector and other public sector jobs. It doesn't offer, or at least as it's usually described, it does not offer a very generous benefit package. It's a basic public sector job, right? And there is an argument, and I've heard employers very receptive to this argument, that they would much rather be able to dip into the pool of employed workers in the public employment program and hire from that pool, knowing that these are people whose skills have been kept up, who've been showing up for work on time, who have a record, that there are features about the ELR that they find very appealing. So I think there's probably a mix of sentiments, and I just don't know, at the margin, how correct that Kaletsky assessment is. I don't know.
Okay, we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Were you waiting? I want to make sure that I didn't. Okay, go ahead. I want to make sure to get you. Got time for one or two more.
Well, I was just a little question to Randall. I understand that in the figures for the labor force, people in jail are not considered part of the labor force. So when we compare the United States with Europe, those figures about unemployment should have a correction for the amount of people in jail, which is much, much larger than in Europe. Yes. Is it true?
Yes, it's true. And so
you might consider them employed, however.
Well, going forward, full employment will reduce the number of people going to prison. So going forward, we will be bringing them back. So
right.
I'm not arguing that, career criminals, we're going to, be able to easily integrate them through the job guarantee. I don't believe that. But going forward, we won't have nearly as many people incarcerated if jobs are readily available.
It's an interesting story. And I think it was in the 80s or early 90s. Toyota took over a General Motors factory in California, which was in a shambles. I mean, people were drug addicts, and they wouldn't turn up to work, etc. And in only a few months' time, Toyota managed to make it work. So that, the question about. But there's so many things. I mean, I'm one of the few who has been on the other side of the bar, having been in a central bank for almost 20 years of my life. So I find it necessary to defend a little bit central bankers. Have been under launch or big attack. Counterfactuals, obviously, very devious. But what would have happened if central banks wouldn't have lower interest rates? What we have witnessed during this crisis is a massive default of fiscal policy. I mean, at the very beginning, there was some thing in 2008, 2009. And then all governments went back, under the pressure of a progressing right wing. Big government is wrong. Everything that government does is wrong. And then the pressure shifted over central banks also, which, of course, there are officials, they should be more accountable, etc. Mm. But the pressure also on central banks to raise interest rates because inflation would come, etc., was enormous. Central banks, bankers found themselves in a kind of cultural conflict. I mean, the last quarter of a century, they had been brought up in the idea of this big moderation, et cetera, et cetera. But all of a sudden, they face a practical question, and they introduce all these extraordinary measures, and they did. I mean, Mr. Bernanke had studied, mm-hmm. the 1930s, had studied the Japanese thing, and he did. And Mr. Draghi also did a change in the European Central Bank. So I think there was something there, and it would be wrong, I think, to throw the baby with the bathwater. Mm. I mean, the central bankers tried to do something. And if you keep attacking the central bankers, it was the only valid thing, little.
The last man standing sort of issue, that, is what you're saying.
You know, that yeah. maintain a little bit a thing.
Yeah. So I think most people would agree with that. We are at time, and I know some of us have trains to catch, so I'm going to have to end it. But I think that's a great position to end it on. A lot has been asked of central bankers. Much has been demanded of our panel. You guys have delivered. Thank you.
Thanks
to everybody for listening.